Hello, this is Jimmy from the Right Dishonourable podcast. This week, we're going to try something a little bit different. You might have noticed that we've been struggling to release podcasts on our former weekly schedule. And so we're going to try launching this new podcast called On The Fringe. It will sit alongside the main podcast and hopefully complement it. The idea behind it is that I or Jazza speak to various people across the political spectrum, but mainly those that don't have access to mainstream media channels, just to gauge their views on things, to ask them about their political philosophies and ideologies, and just try and get some outside perspective on various issues that are happening in British politics, in global politics, just anything that strikes our fancy and is relevant to the discussion. This week, I'm joined by The Academic Agent, who is a YouTuber I've been aware of for some time. I've watched a fair few of his videos. He's one of those people that specialises in slightly long-form content where he dissects things that are going on in British politics, discusses books, discusses ideas in general, really. I think there's sort of an underground of YouTubers, particularly those on the classical liberal side of things, that has not really penetrated into mainstream political discussion all that much. But there's quite a lot of interesting people out there, and The Academic Agent is certainly one of them. I'll leave him to discuss the particulars of his views, what he thinks about things in economics, in terms of the culture wars, social issues, and hopefully you'll enjoy this and see it as something to go alongside, but not to replace the main podcast, which will be back in due course. Give me any feedback you want, leave me any suggestions as to how we can improve these, whether you want more of them or hopefully not less of them, but we'll also field those comments as well. But I will now be playing some music and getting on with the interview. So maybe could you start just by outlining who you are as an internet personality, and if possible also giving some indication of what you do in the real world, as it were.
Okay, well, I have a YouTube channel called The Academic Agent, and on that I make videos about economics, politics, sometimes also history and philosophy, and I also host live streams on there as well with various guests, which are a bit more... So, you know, on YouTube you can make edited videos that are 5-10 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And then the live streams are more like podcasts, I guess. And it's just a different environment where you can interact with people. I'm also a real life academic. I've written 5 books. And recently, under my real name, I've started writing articles for a pretty well-known and widely distributed online site. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing articles about the state of academia, political discourse, politics in general. The reason I keep my anonymity on YouTube is nothing to do with my actual views. It's much more because I don't want a pile of YouTube stuff coming up when students and colleagues Google my name. You know, somebody's looking for an article of mine, and you know, they're hit with the first page of Google is literally all YouTube videos. That wouldn't look very good, I don't think.
Is that because of the what it is you're talking about, or is it the style of video?
It's nothing to do with my opinions. I've said before, I'd happily state all of my views on national television. It's just to do with not wanting like different worlds to clash. And my name, my real name, is not like John Smith, where there's hundreds and hundreds of them in the world. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, there are not many people with a name like mine in the world. So it would come up. I mean, I've got things that I wrote on the internet when I, you know, back in like 1998, you know, back in AOL days. I posted something on like a David Bowie forum, and it still comes, you know, it still comes up. Mm-hmm. So it's stuff like that I'd rather... You know, when you have an academic career, you kind of want to guard that front page of Google quite well, because sure, it's your career, you know. So
for people who aren't familiar with your videos, which I'd have thought would be most of the people listening to us, what's your political philosophy, would you say, if you could sum it up simply?
Yeah, so, well, I'm a classical liberal. in the truest sense. Now that term has been somewhat appropriated. So, for example, I noticed that like Paul Joseph Watson has put in his Twitter handle that he's a classical liberal. I'm not sure whether that's true. Classical liberalism basically means that I am for laissez-faire free market economic policies and a greatly reduced state involvement in business and more generally in people's lives. I don't want the state interfering in my life or your life. And I'm very strongly against the left in all its myriad forms and whatever it calls itself. So that could be socialism, communism, social justice, progressivism. These are all aspects of a utopian vision that is ably summarized by the lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine.
Some people would see liberalism, I mean, in the broad sense, maybe not classical liberalism, but as a left-wing ideology, or at least one that has roots, some roots in there.
No, that's essentially not true. I would, how can I put this? I mean, liberalism itself goes somewhat off the rails around the time of John Stuart Mill, when they accept that there needs to be some sort of welfare provision. The utilitarian thinkers like Jeremy Bentham. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start making utilitarian calculations, you're on the road to socialism, as far as I'm concerned. And that, I think they call it modern liberalism or neoliberalism, is effectively a leftist phenomena. And that's where the confusion between these two different senses of the word liberal come from. It's from that.
So when you say classical liberal, do you see that as an essentially conservative philosophy then?
I don't. It's a philosophy that comes from the Whig tradition in this country, or the old Liberal Party. And conservatism is a very different thing. Conservatism is about preserving traditional ways of life. And I'll give you Edmund Burke is probably the father of conservatism.
Right.
Whereas Adam Smith would be, I guess, the patron saint of classical liberalism. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example in history. Let's say the Corn Laws. You know the Corn Laws of 1848.
Yeah, you should probably explain a little bit of what those are about.
So, in this country, we had a set of laws that tried to fix the price of corn. There was an economist and a philosopher called Thomas Malthus who had a theory of population, and that theory stated that the rate of food, let me get this right, the rate of food will always lag behind the rate of people. So we need to try to control our populations. We don't want populations getting too big, otherwise we're going to suffer mass starvation. Mm-hmm. So they introduced these things called the Corn Laws that were artificially trying to keep the price of corn high so that people could not, they could not afford the corn. And it was also a way to protect landowners. Mm-hmm. And this was a Tory policy. It was a conservative, part of what the conservatives were trying to do is that they were trying to preserve the agricultural way of life. Now the classical liberals, they wanted to get rid of that law, and they wanted to unleash, free market enterprise and essentially allow the industrial revolution to happen. Mm. So the split between conservatives and classical liberals is something that I don't think is readily understood on the left, and it comes. You can see it in clashes between, say, let's say Margaret Thatcher. Okay, what did Margaret Thatcher preserve? What were her conservative? What was she trying to save? If you ask me, she wasn't really trying to save anything because she was a classical liberal. She was unleashing, the free market, and there was arguably much more social, demographic, economic change under Thatcher than there was in the previous. Mm. 20 years.
So I was going to say, as far as mainstream politics go, would you agree that kind of classical liberalism is kind of best represented within a certain wing of the Tory party? We could call it the Thatcherite wing, but whatever name you want for it.
Yeah. Well, it would be the Thatcherite wing these days. It's kind of difficult to find people, but someone like Dan Hannan is a classical liberal, I'd say. Jacob Rees-Mogg to an extent, although he mixes it with some high Toryism, which is, you know, he's obviously socially conservative on with his religious views, for example. But one aspect of classical liberalism is that you see those things like morality as being outside of the purview of the state itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so whatever your morality is, that's really up to you. It's not for the state to decide. And that is, I mean, the guiding principle is liberty, obviously. That's what I see myself trying to defend.
Is that the reason you started your YouTube channel, to actually kind of promote those ideas?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different things. So how can I put this? There's quite a lot to get into here. I want to start with really what I find wrong with the left. And
when you say the left, do you mean the British left or just the left?
I mean the left in all its different forms. Okay, so, and if I was to say, well, what unites the left in all its different forms, I would say it is probably a basic denial of human nature, which clouds all of their thinking. I mean, one of the books that was very important for me was Steven Pinker's The Blank Slate, which demolishes social constructivism. And if you, without social constructivism, a lot of the kind of key leftist tenets are knocked away. Like, for example, you know, you look at any issue, crime, for example. Do people commit crime because they're bad people, or are they victims of society? You know, the social constructivist argument says that they're victims of society. There was a study released the other day that showed that, you know, criminal behavior is 97% inheritable.
So by social constructivism, you mean the view that environmental social influences shape who we are?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to more than it really goes back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who had this view that you know, in the state of nature, human beings are equal, and they live in harmony and peace. You know, this idea of the noble savage. The only thing that's gone wrong is that as civilization has developed, humanity has erected bad institutions. You know, this idea that man is free but everywhere born in chains. Mm-hmm. This is at the heart of essentially all leftist thinking. They think that as long as you change if you change the institutions, if you change the way society works, then human beings will follow. You know, this was the idea in the for the Soviets, you know, or the communists. You know, if you just change the way that capitalism works, human beings are magically going to stop being greedy, you know. And this comes from, I think, a denial of biological human reality in the first place. And for me, politics has to start, or morality and then politics, have to start with a recognition of what human beings are. And once you are swayed by the evidence, then leftism in all its forms seems to be completely untenable to me.
I think some people will probably be listening to this, and particularly if they consider themselves off the left, and they'll find it slightly unfair that you're lumping together, say, social democrats with communists, with, you know, progressives in the kind of Blairite sense. So,
yeah, well, they all get the same thing wrong, which is a basic failure to understand human beings. And therefore, they fail to track what I would call long-run effects. They do not consider incentives. So it doesn't really matter what you call them. They're getting the same thing wrong. To differing degrees, granted. You know, the social democrat is not as stupid as the full-blown communist, because they, you know, they still recognize that you need to have some aspects of a functioning market. But they're getting the same. They're getting the same things wrong, which is why it's fair to lump them together, I think.
So your kind of alternative to that idea of, you know, man is naturally free but is ever, you know, everywhere bound in chains. You, what is your alternative to that? What do you think the true vision is?
And I should, if people want to follow this up more, another really important thinker is Thomas Sowell, who wrote a book called A Conflict of Visions, where he outlines this. But it's basically a more realist view of humanity, that human beings, you know, the reason that people do bad things is because they've chosen to do bad things. Maybe it's because they're selfish. Maybe it's because they're greedy. And it's a recognition that you're not going to be able to fix human beings. We're animals, after all. So because we're not able to fix human beings, you then have to think about incentive structures that are going to funnel our instincts into the best ends. Does that make sense to you? Now, if you take it as a given that people are going to be self-interested and follow their own interests, then you want to come up with structures that take that as a given. And it seems to me that the left never do this. I'll give you an example, a very concrete example. A while back, Jeremy Corbyn came up with this thing. There are 8,000 homeless people, and he wants to, as a solution, give them 8,000 homes. Now, if you consider long-run effects and incentives, can anybody listening, or can you, Jimmy, see the problem or the potential pitfalls of such a policy?
It encourages people not to work, I suppose. It encourages people to become homeless, potentially, in order to gain the benefit.
Yeah, you've created a perverse incentive for people to be homeless. And all of a sudden, you've created like a kind of ever expanding burden for society now to pay for, which is another thing that happens with so many policies that come up with people who don't understand human nature. I cannot think of a social program that has not just snowballed ever since it was introduced. I mean, we can look at the NHS, for example. It's ridiculous.
Is your view that ultimately welfare systems always become sustainable over the long term? Because I think many people would look at the development of the West, sort of Western states since World War II, and say, actually, a lot of these welfare programs have ameliorated the problems that they set out to, and they haven't necessarily all ended up burgeoning, as you put it.
Well, I mean, I would look at debt to GDP ratios, for example. There are ways to balance the books. If we really want to get down into the meat and bones of it, one of the things that Owen Jones or Bernie Sanders never mentions when they're advocating Nordic models, for example, is that the Swedes and the Norwegians, they run extremely free markets, okay, and they set very competitive corporate tax rates to encourage business. But at the same time, they have incredibly high welfare spends and quite high levels of income tax. I think it's 60% in Sweden. But what that means is that they're able to pay for everything. I mean, they practice what leftists in this country call austerity. You know, austerity is a dirty word for Corbynistas. But yet the places that implement the policies they want to see basically pay for the things that they want to implement. Now, I'm not saying that all of those policies have necessarily had good effects. I would probably dispute that. And it would take us a much longer conversation to go through like the individual data on each of those programs. But I would suggest that generally they've created bad, you know, for example, in Denmark, there's a ridiculous proportion of the population in Denmark are on welfare. I think it's as high as 20% of people don't work there. Which seems insane to me, but there's another set of concepts that have been very influential in my thinking that I think might be helpful for listeners and also for you to understand where I'm coming from, and that is Isaiah Berlin's concepts of positive and negative liberty. Isaiah Berlin had this idea of negative liberty as opposed to positive liberty, and negative liberty simply means that people leave you alone; they don't infringe on you. You know, I have a right to my own business, and you do not have a right to punch me in the face, okay? And the British way of life for centuries has been built on this principle from the bottom up. If you look at British common law, it really has negative liberty at its heart, the law is meant to protect your freedom from the unwanted interference of others. And that's why it's correct that if you steal something from my property, you should be brought to justice. Positive liberty, meanwhile, is a much more continental concept, especially French. And I mentioned Rousseau before and the French Revolution. It really comes from Rousseauian thinking. And positive liberty includes things like human rights. But if you look at what many of those...
Wouldn't human rights also encompass a lot of things that you describe as negative liberty as well?
Yeah, so this is the thing. If you look at the official list of human rights, they commingle things that are negative liberties with things that I describe as positive liberties. And many of the things that are positive liberties are not really rights. I mean, many rights claimed in the positive liberty tradition, I would more accurately describe as compelled action for something. So it's literally compelling me and you to do something on behalf of another group of people.
So what's an example of a positive right then?
So, I mean, I think of benefits or entitlements. You know, it's essentially a group of people forcing everybody else to do something because they have either through violence or coercion made it so. I'll give you an example. My colleagues recently went on strike over their pensions. I don't know if you saw that in the news, that the universities, lots of lecturers went on strike because their protected pensions were being threatened. Did you see that?
Sure, yeah, I saw that.
Now, what they were effectively saying was that other people should pay for their retirement. So when you say, and this is a...
You're talking about some sort of taxpayer subsidy towards the pension pot?
They're effectively saying that the university sector as a whole, regardless of how they find the money, despite there being a 17.5 billion deficit in the pension pot, that is, if everybody was paid what they were meant to be at the end, when they retire, year on year, there's a 17.5 billion pound hole in the budget. So the money is set to run out, essentially. Mm. But what this strike was about was saying, well, we don't care about that. You're going to pay us no matter what. and you can see how this is an idea. This is basically putting a cost on someone else and claiming that cost as a right. It's very different from simply saying, look, you don't have a right to punch me in the face. This is saying it is incumbent on you to do something for me.
Couldn't you argue that the protection of a lot of negative liberties, so say free speech, for instance, tends to involve the use of a police force, the use of a court system, because obviously these things will be infringed upon in some instances and you need ways of punishing that and incentivizing people not to infringe upon those things. And there is a cost involved there, isn't there?
Yeah, so there are no solutions, only trade-offs, as they say. Mm-hmm. But I would say that, I mean, if you think about the rise of what the police were meant to be in the first place, if you track, you know, Robert Peel and all the rest of it, it was meant to be a safeguard against these people who were trying to infringe on others. And people, through their own free association, by giving taxes and funds, would enter into a kind of insurance system to protect their own property and their own person, and that's kind of quite a benign, you know, it's rare to find libertarians being that benign about the state. Mm-hmm. But in the most charitable possible reading of what the police are, that is what is meant to have happened. If you ask me, that has been corrupted over the years, especially by Labour governments who have given the police more and more powers, and it's effectively now the state versus the people, as opposed to the state trying to protect the people from those who would encroach upon them.
Mm. I suppose you mentioned the trade-off thing. I'd probably argue that the distinction between negative and positive liberty, even though there is one there, they sort of seep into each other a little bit, certainly at the margins. And I mean, isn't there an argument you could make that yes, positive rights. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are a newer thing, but they're something that developed off the back of negative rights, but that doesn't mean that they're inherently bad.
Well, I guess my question would be, like, let's just think of some like really fundamental things. You know, is it a human right for someone to have housing or food? You know, that's basically you saying it's incumbent on everyone else to see to it that this person has shelter and is fed.
Well, a lot of people would say yes, wouldn't they?
But that's not a right, is it? That's a kindness being done for that person as a charitable act by everybody else. And this is one of the things that I dislike about the left so much, is because they're continually trying to make things that started out as voluntary, you know, acts through free association, that they try to make them mandatory, and then they then seek to compel these things through the law. And what they're effectively saying is that me and you now, we not only have to pay for ourselves to live and eat, but we also have to pay for that guy over there. Why? I mean, I find it morally repugnant. And I'm convinced that the left in general is against a genuine concept of liberty for individuals, and that's why socialism tends historically towards totalitarianism, because you know you keep on compelling more and more. And it's also why British society as a whole, as it's tilted more left since 1945, I mean, it probably starts with the Attlee government. The UK state has become ever more totalitarian and is now, if you ask me, more or less openly Orwellian.
What would you say to someone who brings up the kind of the John Rawls veil of ignorance argument, that being that you know, a lot of success in life is essentially down to luck, either in the form, you know, the form of genetic inheritance, the form of what social background you're born into. A lot of the money that an individual thinks they earn is actually just down to those chances and circumstances. What would you say to that?
So what I'd say is, why do you privilege some areas of inequality more than others when it comes to this? So they tend to, so Marxists especially tend to focus on money and material goods, okay? But people are unequal in every single different way. I mean, Thomas Hobbes has a famous passage somewhere where he says, you know, some people are fast, some people are strong, some people are good looking, some people are tall, some people are short. How far do you take this? You know, do you want, so you could probably find empirical data to show that on average, if you're very attractive, you probably have, certainly if you're tall, you earn more, and certainly if you're attractive, you have more opportunities in life. So
you're sort of referencing the halo effect with the attractiveness thing, that people see one good quality and they assume others in a person.
Right. And so that strikes me as being quite unfair. So, you know, I'm reasonably good looking, but I'm not Brad Pitt. And like that guy over there is, you know, wasn't born the most attractive person in the world. So I want facial justice. Give me facial justice. I want, you know, why shouldn't that guy over there have plastic surgery to up his looks, and that guy over there have plastic surgery to down their looks? So, what, I mean, why do we accept? Why, I mean, that sounds like a terrible and dystopian thing to do, but why would we accept it in that area and not? Why would we not accept it in that area, but we do accept it in other areas of life?
I suppose people find certain kind of personal infringement sorts of, you know, forced plastic surgery more objectionable than, say, just redistributing income for whatever reason.
But so you accept then you are forcibly and coercively taking people's possessions away from them to give them to somebody else.
I think anyone who thought about taxes would have to accept that, but some people would still come to the conclusion that it was justified. You see what
I mean? I think it's justified where the services that are being provided are genuinely protecting the liberties of the people. So in the area of the police, for example, okay, how are we going to fund that? You know, either we set up a private kind of insurance police force, but that doesn't seem to work because it leaves too many people out. So, all right, let's make it a tax. And so I can see the logic for certain services, but these things have a tendency to spiral way beyond their original remits.
I mean, some people, you mentioned the impracticality of running a police force off a kind of insurance scheme. Mm-hmm. In terms of like a national health service then, couldn't you make similar arguments, particularly when you consider the downsides of having say, I mean, in some sense, it makes sense to treat someone with a contagious disease, even if they don't have insurance, because it protects yourself. So there's certain instances where a national tax based thing makes sense, even on your terms, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, the NHS is a rather difficult thing, but I guess one of the questions I've always had is, I mentioned food and clothing; those are two things that have historically not been provided by the state, have they? They have been provided by private businesses, and if you have a look at the cost of food and the cost of clothes over time, they have continuously gone down, and the choice of food and the choice of clothes have continually increased. I mean, you just need to go to, I don't know, Oxford Circus to see the choice of clothes, or you need to go to Sainsbury's to see the choice of food. And all of those things have been provided by the market. But in those areas which have been provided by the state, like the education system, for example, or like the NHS, the costs have consistently gone in exactly the opposite direction. So, the quality of food and the quality of clothes and the variety of clothes have all gone up, and the price has gone down. But in these areas that have been dominated by state control, the exact opposite thing has occurred. And my question is, why is that? Why are state-run institutions the only institutions in which failure is rewarded by more money? I mean, we're talking about incentives. What happens if the NHS starts to fail? They just pump more money into it. I think the Tories announced that they were going to release an extra, it's the 70th birthday of the NHS, and I think they're releasing an extra 100 billion in funds or something. There's going to be a new cash injection.
Well, is it not the case that the NHS has actually succeeded in the sense that it's contributed to larger life expectancies? Arguably, it's also helped to eliminate certain diseases and certain conditions in the UK. But obviously, with that success comes the extra burden of people living longer and so on. So it has been a success, but ultimately, that has contributed to it costing more money because of the way it's set up.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the Henry Hazlitt thing. You know, the government builds a bridge, and you see the benefits of the bridge that it has built, but you do not see all of the unbuilt things or all of the things that did not happen, that might have happened. Because through command and control, you've allocated resources in that way. I mean, I'll give you one example with the NHS. I think they've currently got 1 in 7 nurse jobs unfilled, which seems insane. Okay, so they've got 7 vacancies, and for every 7 vacancies, only one of those jobs gets filled, and that job typically does not get filled by a British trained nurse. It gets filled with an Eastern European trained nurse. Meanwhile, wages for nurses are 20% lower than they are elsewhere in Europe. Now, how can you have a situation where there's a shortage of nurses, but the price of nurses does not? I mean, some basic economics, right? If demand rises for a thing and there's a shortage of supply, the price has to rise. But of course, that natural mechanism is denied because you've got, Theresa May or whoever happens to be in the government centrally controlling all of these things. Mm-hmm. And so you get this kind of systemic inefficiency. And okay, we protect the NHS and people like it, and it's one of the few things that British people seem to rally around. But that doesn't stop the fact that it's essentially like a little hub of communism spiraling out of control in the middle of our country. It doesn't stop it being true. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went down to, there's a pharmacist down here, and I went to grab a prescription a couple of weeks back, and I think I paid £8 for it. I said, how much did this cost you? He said, oh, well, I paid £64 for it. I was like, oh, right. But who's charged that? So the pharmacist isn't by himself. He charged the NHS the £64. And then he said, well, basically 80% of people don't even pay for that. I just thought to myself, well, if you have every single part of the system where the costs to the central government keep on rising and rising, the market mechanisms which drive efficiency and which drive prices down aren't allowed to operate at any part of the system. So it's naturally going to keep on getting more and more expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, they could probably pump another £1 trillion into the NHS tomorrow, and in 5 years' time, someone like Jeremy Corbyn will still be saying there's not enough money in there. You know, they've been doing it for decades.
So I think you've sort of outlined your kind of pro markets and also kind of laissez-faire in the social sphere kind of views. Did you have a particularly sort of varied political journey on the way to these views? How did you actually come to adopt these positions?
It's mainly through reading, I would say. I think the
have you always been a classical liberal?
I would say I've always tended towards thinking these things, but I think one of the great barriers that people have in coming to their views is actually this. I mean, I hate to bang on about this, but the state education system, which has got a lot of, essentially pro-left or pro-state propaganda, all the way through it. So,
well, what do you mean by that, pro-state propaganda?
I mean, there's a basic awareness of facts that is missing. I'll give you some examples, okay? In the American education system, kids are routinely told that FDR's New Deal policy saved America, you know, in the Great Depression.
So that was mass injection of funds, right, and spending after the Great Depression.
That's right.
Okay.
But in actuality, all those measures that FDR passed turned a normal recession into the Great Depression. And you can look at the actual unemployment numbers. You know, in 1929, 2 months after the Wall Street crash, it was 9%, okay? By 1930, in June, it was down to 6%. Then Herbert Hoover started passing all of these big government programs in 1932. It shot up to 20%. When FDR came in 1933, he passed like an absolutely massive raft of these big government social programs. And the unemployment rate stayed above 20% for the next 6 years. Now, economists who have known this for decades. You know, they've known that the New Deal had absolutely terrible effects, but children are still taught that FDR was a hero and the New Deal saved the country. Another one would be Thatcher, okay? Thatcher seems to take, you know, basically sole blame for the collapse of the coal and the steel industries, when in fact anyone with an iota of honesty would say, well, you know, the collapse of these industries happened because the British government nationalized the coal mines, nationalized the factories, implemented a raft of really bad Keynesian policies that led to the economic crisis of the 70s, the 3-day week, the winter of discontent. I mean, in the 1960s, I think we had a top rate of tax of 98%. Mm. That's why the Beatles sang Taxman and buggered off to Switzerland.
So I'm assuming that you don't just think that the historical syllabus is slanted this way.
Well, I think okay, if kids were taught this, why are so many of them supporting Jeremy Corbyn now? I mean, clearly they don't know this, because they wouldn't be doing this otherwise, would they?
Given that the Tories managed to get around 40% and Labour managed to get around 40% in the last general election, it would seem that the education system, at least historically, hasn't been this unbalanced, even if.
But if you drill down into that data, many people arrive at positions on the quote unquote right after they've had some life experience.
So, I mean, people also tend to move to the right once they accumulate capital assets as well. So there's various ways of looking at it.
So they've accumulated some money. They've had a proper job, but they've also seen how the real world works. And I think that some of that stuff that you're taught growing up, and some of the caricatures of Tories, you know, I mean, Thatcher was, you know, they were burning effigies of Thatcher when she died, and they hang a flag over the Manchester Bridge saying "Hang the Tories." No, nobody seems to care. Like this is the level of the attacks from the left to the right.
Generally a small fringe on the left who do that sort of thing. Do you not think?
I don't think. I think the left have a habit of seeing their opponents as fundamentally evil and lacking in human decency, and therefore they seek their destruction as opposed to dialogue or sensible exchanges with them.
I mean, Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail, has just stepped down, and his paper is certainly of the view that the left at points is evil or malignant or underhand, if not just stupid as well. So there's a bit of slanging on both sides.
I would say it's not. I mean, there's the fallacy of Aristotle's golden mean. It's not equal. It's not an equal. I mean, go on Twitter and have a look at the. I think there was a report that the Daily Mail editor stepped down. Just have a look at the replies to that and tell me if the two sides are equal. I mean,
Twitter leans left, doesn't it, in terms of its user base.
Well, it depends on which parts you hang out in.
True, but I mean, generally speaking, there are more left-wing Twitter users than right-wing Twitter users. You know, obviously it depends who you follow, but I thought it was just, you know, take it for granted that that was the case.
There are some other really disturbing things I found as well, you know, in since having the channel. One of the things is that, you know, Tony Blair is talked about, you know, Momentum activists talk about Tony Blair as being a centrist, right? And I think generally the political wisdom is to think of Blair as a centrist person.
Some of them seeing him as a right-wing person. Do you not think?
And now, like, the Corbynistas even see him as being on the right, you know? Now, this is really not true. I think Blair was a radical. Peter Hitchens is very good on this, actually. He says that Britain experienced something like the Chinese Cultural Revolution under Blair. You know, it's just that he wasn't focused on the economics. He was focused on the culture and the values. Douglas Murray's got a book called The Strange Death of Europe. I don't know if you've read that. But he charts in that how under Blair they rapidly imported immigrants at rates far above that which Enoch Powell predicted, as a deliberate policy, as a kind of deliberate social justice policy. The minister involved is called Barbara Roach, you can pull up her quotes if you're interested. And one shocking discovery I made looking into Blair was how, do you remember he had that? Slogan, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Well, he basically changed how crime data was recorded, because he needed to show that that policy was a success, right? So rather than counting total convictions, they instead wanted to count victims. And therefore, since 2003, official crime data in this country is reported on the basis of surveys. You know, like how they do TV ratings.
Mm-hmm.
Crime numbers now are basically done like that. They'll survey a victim in their property in a given area, and then based on those surveys, they make kind of aggregate estimates. So, using this new method, Blair could show that violent crime declined 44% under his watch. But if you look at the total conviction numbers, crime actually increased. Violent crime increased 64%. And in that same period, the population only grew 6.84%. So you can't really put it down to there being more people. And this is the sort of Orwellian aspect that I was talking about. Like, that should be, you know, the public being told that the violent crime is down 44% when it's actually increased 64%, it is the sort of thing that people should be worried about.
I mean, surely politicians have, you know, misled with statistics for as long as they've been around in, you know, heavy usage. Do you not think? Do you think that Blair was particularly guilty of it?
I think the thing that happened under Blair was the complicity of the media in this. That's what makes it Orwellian, the fact that the state and the media are on the same page when it comes to things as fundamental as violent crime. You know, this is real people being killed or beaten up in the street. And, you know, you're being told it's your country's getting safer when in fact it's getting more dangerous. And now in London, it's very difficult to hide, isn't it, under old Sadiq Khan, because those numbers are pretty shocking. And they've come out.
Do you not follow Steve Pinker, obviously? Steven Pinker wrote a book, The Best Rangers of Our Nature, and more recently Enlightenment Now, where he discusses kind of gradual falls in, say, homicide rates and various, obviously, life expectancy. Lots and lots of different life outcome metrics do appear to have improved over the long term. Do you agree with that? And how do you see what you just said fitting into that?
I think there are a lot of problems with what Pinker says in that book. Not in the long, in the very long term, he's obviously right. You know, 1950 was a much more peaceful society than like 1100, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look into crime data since 1950, it's you know, there was a massive spike in the 60s. You know, with the rise of single parent families, violent crime increased massively. The homicide rate increased massively in this country. I mean, I happen to have looked into this in some detail. I'd have to pull up the numbers. But if you look at, say, crime statistics of 1911 or even like the 1800s, do you really think that life was that fewer people were getting killed? Do you really think that more people were getting killed on average in 1911 than they are today?
Your broad thesis is that, say, since World War II, crime has increased, or certain types of crime have increased in the UK.
I think crime spiked massively, not just in the UK, in America and across Europe, after the counterculture moment of the 1960s.
Yeah, so bring it back to this point about Blair. You think that you think it was in his intention to revolutionise British culture in what way exactly?
Well, to make it more right on, to make it more progressive.
What does that mean in practical terms?
Well, I mean, I think the quiet rise of the modern social justice type values and the quiet but very rapid and extreme takeover of institutions by social justice types happened under Blair.
Are you talking about sort of, say, pro-LGBT rights and, you know, more conscious of racial bias and that sort of thing?
Some of these sorts of things, yes, I would say.
I mean, as a classical liberal, what exactly is your bone of contention with that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, I think on the racial disparities of income stuff, I would recommend anybody who's interested in this to pick up Sowell's latest book. It was called Discrimination and Disparities.
That was Thomas Sowell, right?
Yeah, Thomas Sowell. And I think this sort of stuff is so, I think it's very detrimental to society to keep on flagging these things up as issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, David Lammy over the Oxford thing in the past couple of weeks, I don't know if you saw that.
So David Lammy, the MP, talked about how, yeah, he suggests that it's much harder for black people to get into Oxford than white people when you compare like for like along other variables.
Yeah, I mean, I thought his analysis was stunningly dishonest. I mean, if you look at the, what's that acronym they use? BAME?
Yeah, Black and Asian Minority Ethnic.
If you look at the number of BAME people who get admitted to Oxford, it's 17%. The UK average, I think the UK population of BAME people is, what, 11%? So they actually over-index as opposed to under-index.
Mm. Sort of moving aside from the particular disputes around, say, pay gaps and that sort of thing. Do you view it as kind of, because as a classical liberal, you presumably want the government to take a fairly hands-off approach to whether people were, say, to whether, say, society was becoming more racially diverse, to whether there's more acceptance for LGBT people and so on and so forth, right?
I mean, I think all of those things are matters for, you know, so it's not my business what you do. But I'd prefer the state to keep out of those things, okay? So it's not really, for me, these shouldn't be like party political issues. Do you know what I mean? So I would have some disagreements with a Peter Hitchens, say, who wants to like impose his morality through the arm of the state too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would say that. Generally my question is, when it comes to looking at social groups and how much they earn, you know, income gaps and all the rest of it, My general question is, why do people want to see an equalization along those grounds? Why does anybody think that, let's say, exactly 3% of people in a given job should be black, or exactly half of people in a given job should be women?
Some people view it as a proxy metric for how fair society is.
Why does anybody expect the outcomes and the life choices of people to conform to what is a set of arbitrary statistics? You know, whatever the total number of people as a national percentage is at any given moment is essentially arbitrary to my life or your life, right? Mm-hmm. So this to me is like systematic of, you know, a leftist thinks that something is wrong. You know, it seems wrong to them that these two figures don't match up. And now they want to go about setting like top-down solutions to something that isn't even a problem.
So what would your stance be in cases where, say society, you know, society obviously was very prejudiced against, much more prejudiced against homosexual people in during the 1980s than it is today. Do you think the state has a valid role in trying to promote tolerance? Because that, in some ways, feeds into your kind of classical liberalism in the sense that people are freer to live their lives as they choose. What's your view on that?
I mean, strictly speaking, I don't think the state should be in the business of morality at all.
What do you mean by morality in that context?
I mean, I don't think it should be promoting... I don't think it should be in the business of promoting any particular set of views on issue. I mean, let's face it, the LGBT issue is an issue around traditional sexual morality, right? There are some people who think that sex itself is that lust is a sin, for example. You know, in the traditional Catholic Church, it was always frowned upon to lust for its own sake, and this is where you get this idea that sex for procreation is good as opposed to sex for pleasure. And you know, my view is, if that's your view, fine. And if you want to congregate in social spaces where you all sit around agreeing about that, that's also fine. But don't ask the state to impose that on everybody else.
And you would say that both of, say, conservative religious views and more kind of progressive pro-LGBT ideologies.
Absolutely. They are essentially two different sets of people trying to tell everybody else how to behave through the state. I don't mind them doing it from their churches or doing it from their, you know, university seminars, if they want to do it that way. But it's a thing for society itself to sort out, mm-hmm. not for the government to set as if it's a philosopher king.
Okay, I wanted to sort of getting towards the end of time here, because I don't want to make this much longer than an hour. But in your kind of role as academic agent, we've already talked a little bit about how you divide your personal life from your mm-hmm. internet life. You've obviously been doing YouTube videos for a while. You do those Google Hangout things, which are more like podcasts. You mentioned, I think, before we started recording that you do podcasts. What's your view on how kind of what's your view on how internet political culture affects mainstream political culture, and also, I guess, feeding mm-hmm. into that, how effective do you think you've been personally in spreading the views you've just described to me among a wider audience in that capacity?
Right. I don't think that the internet has particularly changed political discourse. I think the left have been using the same playbook for many, many years. I think what the internet has done is expose in a very visible way how they operate. So it's one thing for 200,000 sneering, latte-quaffing, right-on people who read The Guardian to do that in the privacy of their own homes and spaces. But it's a very different thing to watch those same 200,000 people swarming and hounding on Twitter. You know, in the 1980s, social justice activists could get away with spouting nonsense in universities. But in 2018, this is altogether more difficult when people have smartphones and can instantly upload or tweet what is going on. So my take really is that the cat is out of the bag, and that those who oppose the left have gotten smarter as to what is going on. And many people who are not really political have also seen what is going on. And the elites are now desperately kind of clinging on and passing whatever insane laws about the pay gap or whatever else they can while they still have the chance. Incidentally, I do view Theresa May as a leftist, and do not let anyone tell you otherwise. She literally speaks the language of social justice, and I do not think she should be leading the Conservative Party.
I mean, a leg aside the point about Theresa May, slightly. we could definitely go into that. But I think since I've been following you at least, my impression is that you're much harder on, say, far left, you've said social justice warriors, leftists in general, than you are on what could be bracketed as the alt-right or the alternative right online. Is that a fair appraisal of your views, and do you think that's a fair appraisal of your output as well?
I mean, look, I talk about a lot about economics on my channel, but during my time online, what I've seen increasingly is that the issue of the day is not really economics, it's identity, okay?
So it's the culture wars type thing.
Yeah, the culture wars are chiefly a battle over identity. And Roger Scruton actually wrote a really good book recently called Where We Are.
He's a conservative philosopher.
Yeah, and there's another really good book called The Road to Somewhere by David Goodhart, which sets up that somewhere versus anywhere dynamic. But
somewhere in that case would be someone who's more rooted to a place, like to England, say, and anywhere is a citizen of the world, in their phrase.
That's exactly right. Now, in that book, Scruton talks about three different types of communities, okay? He talks about tribal communities, creed communities, and communities who are invested in a particular location. Now, it seems to me that the left is a creed community. It's a kind of religion. That's why it doesn't respect national boundaries. And that's why people on the left so often seem to those outside of the left to hate their own countries. Incidentally, like Islam would be another creed community, of course. Okay. Mm. Now the alt-right, who are explicitly white nationalist, they're white supremacist, and they're obsessed with things like IQ statistics. Okay, they're essentially fascists, and I know this because I have debated some of them in front of thousands of people. I appeared on a show called Worski Live, where I debated one of the well-known leaders of the alt-right called Greg Johnson. Okay. They are clearly a tribal community. That is, they want to associate on the basis of race. Okay, they want to bring ideas of like kin and family bonds, and you know, they speak in terms of my people as opposed to my country. And to confuse things further, the left are also in bed with some tribalists. Like, for example, Black Lives Matter are effectively like a black supremacist movement, if you read what they say. I went to a conference last year, a pretty big and famous and established one, and they had Black Lives activist speakers as like the keynotes there. I mean, they're basically racial identitarians in exactly the same way as the alt-right are. So I do view the alt-right as an issue. I don't like to see this. But generally, the reason why I lament the left more than this small group of identitarians, seems to me they've done a real damage to this identity based on place or location, okay? You know, like in the West, in Europe, in Britain, our sense of history, our sense of pride, our sense of belonging have all been eroded. You know, these narratives of white guilt and post-colonialism and the labeling of anyone who's patriotic as racist, that's been really damaging. You know, when the Swedish culture secretary says there's no such thing as Swedish culture, she might as well have been spitting in the face of Swedish people. Now, ironically, I'm not, if I had to categorize myself, I've never been patriotic. Particularly, I'm very much an anywhere person as opposed to a somewhere person, you know, as you'd expect from, you know, an actual academic in a real university. But I think that people like me need to realize that most people in most places are somewhere people, not anywhere people.
What do you view as the long-term solution to that kind of, well, not, I don't want to say problem, but if it's true what you say, that most people are somewheres, and I think in David Goodhart's book, he says that 50% of British people probably are somewheres and about a quarter are anywheres, yeah. And then there's the rest. How do you actually deal with that on a practical level?
Well, I think you have to, first of all, take their concerns on board and not, like, dismiss them and call them racist. I mean, look at what's happened to Jordan Peterson, okay? The sheer amount of smears and labels and accusations, and they've called him alt-right and the Nazi, and they even called, like, Candace Owens, like, far-right recently, okay? I think the more they do that, the more you're going to push people into, I guess, to start listening to the more extreme voices on the internet. It hasn't worked with Peterson. Like, I think he sold out Wembley Arena, and he's basically a rock star now. But if you look at the situation across Europe at the moment, you know, the new Italian government that's come in, the five star in the league. If you look at Macron versus Le Pen in France, which was two outside candidates. You look at Sebastian Kurz in Austria. You can look at, even in Sweden, you know, right on utopian social democratic Sweden, the so-called far-right party there has a 20% share of voting intention as things stand, okay? So the more, it seems to me that the tactic of basically saying, oh, you people are stupid, you are Nazis, you are, you know, you're extremists, is not working, because the center-left vote in all of Europe has collapsed. I mean, it's completely fallen out. The last person standing is, ironically, Theresa May. So, you know, as a true centre-left person. So, yeah, I do think the left need to abandon this tactic of smearing and labelling and start arguing with facts and evidence. And of course, they won't do that because the facts and the evidence aren't on their side. So they're going to keep on doubling down. But my ideal scenario is for people to really argue on those lines, as opposed to calling each other names.
So I don't think you answer my question as to how successful you think you've been in converting people.
Well, I mean, I can only look at the people who, I mean, I currently have 13,000 subscribers. So I'm not Sargon of Akkad, who's a big buddy of mine, who's got more like a million. But it's still a sizable amount of people. All I can go on is the people I see in the comments. And I know that there have been a few people who started out being on the left or calling themselves social democrats that have since come around. And it's really those people who are open to just looking at the facts, looking at the evidence, and considering for themselves, well, what is true? And if you care about the truth, as I hope so, most people do, look at the facts for yourselves. And
since you mentioned Sargon of Akkad as well, this is something I think that's worth bringing up, is that a lot of the, I'm not including yourself in this bracket, but there's a lot of people who would term themselves classical liberal, and this kind of brings us back to the start of the podcast and defining that term, yeah. who do appear to be buddies or at least affiliated with people who would be alt-right or far-right. I mean, Sargon of Akkad, I think, was pictured not so long ago with Paul Joseph Watson, who's obviously InfoWars and is more far right, I would say. I mean, do you agree with that characterization?
Not really. I mean, if you're in that world and you follow these things, you would know that Sargon of Akkad is one of the greatest enemies of the alt right. I mean, they hate him. I mean, he debated Richard Spencer in a very widely watched debate, and the alt-right have had a campaign against him ever since.
But he does sort of in his videos use things like the Pepe the Frog, which is a symbol of the alt-right, and he does kind of toy with some of the tropes and symbols of the alt-right.
Well, I mean, there's a question over which, are those really alt-right symbols, or have they been labeled as such in the same way that the media have labeled Jordan Peterson as alt-right or Candace Owens as alt-right? It seems to me that the left have always done this, you know, like there's, as far as I can see, no area of common ground between, let's say, Adolf Hitler, Margaret Thatcher, a Southern Baptist preacher, Winston Churchill. I mean, you can keep on, like, all of these people are nominally on the right. Mm-hmm. And what the left do is that they want to try to define anyone who opposes them as being a fascist, and that's what they've done historically. I mean, you look at Hitler's policy platform and Margaret Thatcher's policy platform and tell me how they're the same. And in the same way, look at Sargon of Akkad's policy platform and Richard Spencer's and tell me how they're the same. They're not. I mean, and this is like all of these things, like guilt by association, you know, obsessing over labels. These are dishonest ways of thinking that we need to abandon.
Mm-hmm. Is there just a final question? Is there anyone who is on the left that you would say you admire, kind of on an intellectual level or any other level, actually?
I mean, they have had one thing. I tell you what. I'll give this. Okay. Some of the so-called cultural Marxists of the 1960s and previously, I would say Louis Althusser, for example, the Frankfurt School, Antonio Gramsci would be another one. If you look at what they said and what actually ended up happening, their set of tactics, probably Saul Alinsky would be another one. I would say nobody could look at what they said to do versus what has actually happened and say that they haven't been successful in subverting the Western cultures and undermining capitalism. They didn't change the economic system to the extent that they may have liked, but they certainly won on the cultural front. So I would say that many aspects of their analysis was correct on its own terms.
You mean in the sense they saw how to manipulate the system as it was?
In the sense that their analysis of how a culture works and how to subvert a culture was essentially correct.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're trying to end this, Jimmy, but this is going to be contentious. But one of the things that I think is that you have to be taught to be a leftist, okay? Whereas people almost kind of default to not being one. This is why user-generated content, like let's say talk radio stations or YouTube, they tend to swing to the right, whereas top-down ones tend to be dominated by the left.
Mm. You don't agree with, say, Jonathan Haidt's analysis that people tend to be born sort of with left-wing or right-wing predispositions to a certain degree. I mean, that's a very crude rendering of what he actually thinks, but you know what I mean.
I agree with that, lots of what Jonathan Haidt says, but I would say that most people do not default to, for example, seeing somebody who commits outrageous acts of crime as being a victim of society before they think they're a bad person.
Mm.
You know, most people think, oh, that's a bad person, they probably need to be punished. You need to be taught, you need to be taught to think otherwise.
I mean, some people would say that a lot of the advances in sort of human society have actually come from us overcoming our intuitions about certain things like that.
Where I was going with this, though, because I know we're trying to end up, is yes. That... So here's the thing. Because the left need to essentially brainwash or indoctrinate people into their ideology in order to gain support, it means that a lot of those cultural Marxist thinkers I mentioned have an effectively like conspiratorial view of a society that has actually grown up naturally and bottom up. You know, they see it as a top down conspiracy. But ironically, if you read those thinkers, it did give a more or less perfect analysis of the culture that the left created themselves from the 1960s to now. So that's why I think those thinkers are still useful to look at.
Okay. I think we will leave it there. Thanks very much for chatting to me over this hour. Where can people find you on the internet if they want to know more about you and your views?
If you just type in academic agent into YouTube, that's my channel. Give me a subscribe or watch a few of my videos, and tell me what you think.
Okay, thanks very much.
I would say, sorry, Jimmy, before you go.
You can add a postscript if you want.
Yeah, there's one thing I wanted to say, because I've been listening to your Right Dishonorable podcast for a long time.
Sure, yeah.
One of the best ways to combat the left is to deny them the moral turf. One of the reasons I like your podcast is that you systematically deny Jazza any moral high ground, and it drives him wild.
What do you mean by moral high ground in that sense?
Well, it's the how can I put this? If somebody comes at you and says, "Oh, well, you're a racist," for example, they're taking the moral high ground, right? Mm-hmm. And you do not concede that ground automatically, which makes for some very interesting discussions.
Okay, well, that's flattery is always very welcome on this podcast. thanks very much.